I want you to picture something for me.
Okay.
Picture a bridge. It's a massive, sturdy suspension bridge. Cars are driving over it. Commuters are rushing home. Everything looks solid. The engineers check the sensors, and the tension levels are exactly where they're supposed to be. It is the picture of stability.
Right.
And then one bolt snaps. Just one. And within 10 seconds, the entire structure is in the water.
That is a terrifying image to start with.
It is, but it captures this really specific anxiety I think we all have. Why do things that look perfectly fine, I mean, absolutely healthy, catastrophically fail without warning? We see it in businesses that post record profits right before bankruptcy. We see it in people who pass their physicals and drop dead a week later.
It's the paradox of sudden collapse. And usually when that happens, we stand around the wreckage asking, what went wrong? The dashboard was all green lights.
Exactly. We trust the dashboard. But today's deep dive is basically telling us the dashboard is lying to you.
Or at least it's hiding the truth.
Hiding the truth. We are unpacking a concept called compensated fragility.
Which is such a sticky phrase.
It is. It's this state where a system looks stable on the outside, but inside, it is furiously burning through its reserves just to stay standing. It's valid, but it's brittle.
And to understand that, we have to rethink what it means to be alive or healthy in the first place.
Right. So our source material today is a paper titled Life as Viability Under Constraint. It's by Dr. Bechara Saheeli, who is a physician and systems thinker. And get this,
Go on.
he collaborated with an AI to help synthesize the framework.
Which is fascinating in itself, but the content is what really grabs you. Most of the time, when we ask, what is life, we get a list of functions. Life eats, life reproduces, life metabolizes.
That's a to-do list.
Exactly. But this paper takes a constraint-first approach. Instead of asking what life does, it asks, what are the rules life cannot violate if it wants to keep existing?
It's looking at life as a geometry of survival. It sounds a bit abstract, but as I was reading it, I realized this explains everything from why I get burned out to why the global economy is so shaky. So let's unpack this. The paper starts with physics.
To foundation.
It says life is far from equilibrium. Now, usually when I hear equilibrium, I think of work-life balance. I think of Zen. But in this paper, equilibrium is bad.
In thermodynamics, equilibrium is death. Total equilibrium means everything has settled down. The temperature is the same everywhere. Nothing is moving. There is no potential for work. It is dust.
So staying alive is actually a constant fight against settling down.
Think of it like swimming upstream in a raging river. The river is entropy. It's the universe trying to wash you away into disorder.
Right.
To stay alive, to even just stay in one place, you have to constantly paddle. You have to burn energy just to maintain your structure against the current.
Okay, so that brings us to the first requirement of this framework. To survive, you need flux.
Right. You need a continuous throughput of energy and matter. You need food, sunlight, oxygen. If the flux stops, you wash away.
But, and this is the part I liked, energy alone isn't enough. The authors use the example of candle flame. A flame has flux, right? It's burning fuel, it's releasing heat.
It's definitely not in equilibrium.
But is it alive?
No, because a flame has no agency. If the wax runs out, it dies. If a wind blows, it goes out. It lets the energy rip through it until the structure is destroyed.
It's a passive victim of the physics.
Precisely. Which leads to the second requirement, regulation or control.
Right.
Life isn't just a fire, it's a fire that feeds itself. It channels that energy to repair the house while it burns. It uses feedback loops to correct errors.
So if the river pushes me left, I paddle right.
Exactly. But here is the piece of the puzzle that I think is the most brilliant. You have flux, you have control. But the paper says you cannot have control without information.
Okay.
Why is information a physical requirement for survival?
This clicked for me when I thought about the swimmer again. If I'm swimming upstream, and every single swirl and rock in the river is a total surprise to me. What happens?
You have to react in real time. You're thrashing about. It is incredibly expensive energetically.
I'd be exhausted in 10 minutes.
Right. But if you have memory, if you have information stored about the river, you know where the rocks are, you know where the current is slow.
You don't have to paddle as hard.
So information is basically an energy-saving device. It lowers the metabolic cost of survival, and it allows for prediction.
So instead of fixing an error after it hurts you, you anticipate it and avoid it entirely.
And that's the engine of life. Energy fuels information, and information guides energy. It's a closed loop.
That's the triad.
That's it. But knowing how the engine works is only step one. The real insight of this deep dive is understanding where the car is driving.
And this is where we get into the geometry of survival. I love this visual. The paper asks us to imagine a box.
Yes, a state space. Imagine a giant map representing every possible condition a system could be in.
Every variable?
Every single one. Temperature, acidity, heart rate, bank account balance. Every variable is a coordinate on this map.
It's infinite possibilities.
It is. But for any living thing, 99.9% of that map is lethal.
Yep.
If your body temperature goes to 200 degrees, you're off the map. If your oxygen level hits zero, you're off the map. So inside this giant map, there is a small bounded region called the viability set.
The safe zone.
The survival zone. As long as your current state stays inside that box, you exist. You are alive. You can recover.
Okay.
But the walls of that box are what the authors call absorbing boundaries.
That sounds ominous. Absorbing boundaries.
It's a mathematical term for a point of no return. If you bounce off a normal wall, you come back. If you hit an absorbing boundary, you don't. The boundary absorbs you into failure.
So death.
Death, bankruptcy, extinction. It implies irreversibility. You can't unfry an egg. Once you cross that line, the game is over.
So the goal of life isn't to be the fastest or the strongest or the richest. The fundamental goal is don't hit the walls.
Exactly. Stay in the box. But this brings us back to our opening mystery. Why do systems collapse suddenly?
Yeah.
If the goal is just staying in the box, why do healthy-looking systems hit the wall?
This is where we have to talk about option space.
This is the core concept.
Break it down for us, because this is the difference between looking healthy and being healthy.
Let's go back to the hospital. Imagine two patients in an ICU, patient A and patient B.
Okay.
You look at the monitors. Their heart rates are the same. Their blood pressure is the same. Their oxygen is the same. Geometrically, their dots are in the exact same spot in the box.
So on the dashboard, they are identical.
Right. But patient A is a 20-year-old athlete recovering from a routine surgery. Patient B is 90 years old, has failing kidneys, and is on three different machines and four medications just to keep those numbers stable.
Patient B is being forced to stay in that spot.
Correct. Patient A has massive option space. If the power goes out or they get a secondary infection, their body has reserves. They have moves left to make.
Patient B has zero option space.
None. They are maxed out. They are using 100% of their capacity just to stay still.
That is compensated fragility.
Yes. Patient B looks stable, but they are brittle. One tiny disturbance. A push. And because they have no options left to counter it, they hit the absorbing boundary immediately.
This is such a crucial distinction. We are obsessed with performance, the output, the numbers on the screen, but we ignore viability, which is how hard is the system working to produce those numbers?
We ignore the control cost. If you are redlining your engine just to drive 60 miles an hour, you are not the same as the car cruising at 60 with plenty of pedal left.
And this leads to the math part of the paper, which I found surprisingly terrifying.
Oh, yeah.
It explains why the collapse, when it comes, is so fast. The multiplicative rule.
The weakest link rule.
Right. So human beings, we like to think things add up. We think survival is additive. Like, okay, I smoke a pack a day and I don't sleep, but I take a lot of vitamins and I have low stress jobs, so it balances out.
We bargain A plus B plus C. As long as the total is high, we think we're safe.
But the paper says survival is conjunctive.
It's multiplicative.
It's Fiskerenes's 4 months 12. Fiskerenes's boundary times control times option space. And anyone who remembers basic algebra knows what happens if you multiply a string of huge numbers by zero.
The whole thing becomes zero.
Instantly.
Instantly. It doesn't matter if your flux, your energy intake, is a million. If your boundary integrity is zero, meaning you can't keep poisons out, you are dead. If your option space hits zero, you are dead.
This is why the collapse feels so sudden.
Yeah.
You can have three of those factors at 99% and you feel great. But if that fourth factor is slowly draining away,
you don't notice it because the other factors are compensating. You're in that state of compensated fragility. And then the weak link snaps. You hit a threshold.
A phase transition.
Exactly. You go from alive to not alive almost instantly. It's not a slope. It's a cliff.
Let's apply this to the real world. Because once you see this multiplicative rule and this option space idea, you see it everywhere.
Everywhere.
The paper brings up the efficiency trap in business.
This is the classic example. For the last 30 years, the business world has been obsessed with efficiency.
Lean manufacturing.
Just-in-time supply chains.
We want to trim the fat.
Right. But in systems theory, what we call fat or waste is often actually option space.
It's redundancy. It's a buffer.
Exactly. So when a consultant comes in and says, Why do you have all this extra inventory sitting in a warehouse? That's wasted money. They are telling you to delete your option space.
They are telling you to shrink your viability, set to maximize your flux, your profit.
And it works. It works great. You make record profits as long as the world is perfect.
As long as there are no disturbances.
But the moment a disturbance hits, a pandemic, a war, a ship getting stuck in the Suez Canal, you have no inventory. You have no backup suppliers. You have zero moves left.
And because the math is multiplicative,
the system crashes. We saw this happen to the entire global economy. We optimized for performance and sacrificed resilience. We traded our future viability for present day efficiency.
It's like selling your spare tire to buy slightly better gas. It makes sense until you get a flat.
That is the perfect analogy. And we do this to ourselves personally, too. We fill every hour of our calendar. We optimize our output.
I feel attacked.
We all do it. But if you are scheduled down to the minute, you have zero temporal option space. If one meeting runs late or your kid gets sick, your entire day collapses.
You're efficient, but you're fragile.
Exactly.
This leads us to the final part of the paper, which really elevates this whole discussion. It talks about responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not talking about morality or religion. It's talking about geometry.
This is the so what of the framework. If we accept that the definition of life is maintaining viability, staying in the box, then we can objectively define harm.
Go on.
Harm is the depletion of option space. An action is wrong, structurally, geometrically wrong, if it narrows the future path. If an action pushes a system closer to an absorbing boundary, it is an act of non-viability.
So even if something makes a ton of money right now or feels good right now, if it burns up the reserves needed for tomorrow, it is functionally wrong.
It is anti-life. And here is the kicker. Because we live in nested systems, cells inside bodies, bodies inside societies, societies inside ecosystems, you cannot be viable if you destroy the container you're sitting in.
The paper uses the cancer analogy here.
It's the ultimate example. A cancer cell is, in a way, very successful. It has high flux, it grows fast, it outcompetes its neighbors, it ignores the regulations of the body.
It's optimizing for its own short-term performance.
But by destroying the boundaries and the viability of the host, it guarantees its own destruction. When the host hits the absorbing boundary death, the cancer dies too.
It's a local success that creates a global failure.
Exactly. And the paper argues that humanity is often behaving like that cancer cell. We maximize our economic flux by degrading the ecosystem's boundaries. We eat up the buffers of the planet.
We are eating the walls of our own box.
And geometry tells us there is only one outcome for that. You cannot survive the collapse of the system that contains you.
This is heavy, but it's also clarifying. It takes all these complex ethical problems and turns them into a design challenge.
The goal is to maximize option space.
Right. The responsible action is the one that keeps the most doors open for the future.
Yeah.
So let's bring this down to the listener. If I'm driving home listening to this and I want to apply viability under constraint to my actual life, what do I do?
You have to look for your zeros. Remember the multiplicative rule? You can't just focus on what you're good at. You have to find the weak link.
So don't just look at where you're succeeding. Look at where you're failing.
Right. You might be killing it at work. High flux. But how is your boundary integrity? Do you have no boundaries with your boss? How is your control capacity? Are you sleeping?
And the big one, option space.
Are you living paycheck to paycheck? Are you emotionally maxed out? If you are, you are in compensated fragility. You might feel stable, but you are one shock away from a fall.
So the move is to stop optimizing for output and start building reserves.
Exactly. And this redefines rest. In our culture, we think of rest as doing nothing. It feels lazy.
Yeah.
But in this framework, rest is the active rebuilding of option space.
It's widening the walls.
It's restoring the buffer so that when the next wave comes, you don't hit the rock. It is the prerequisite for long-term existence.
That is such a powerful reframe. I'm not being lazy. I'm geometrically expanding my viability set.
Try telling that to your boss. But it's true.
It really changes how you look at the world. You stop being impressed by things that are just big or fast, and you start respecting things that are resilient.
You start respecting the ability to endure, the ability to handle the unexpected.
So here's the thought I want to leave everyone with. We spend our lives asking, how well is this system performing? But maybe the question we need to ask is, how hard is it working just to stay here?
And how many moves do we have left?
Exactly. Check your dashboard. But don't trust the green lights until you've checked your reserves.
Wise words.
Thanks for helping us unpack the geometry of survival. And to you listening, take care of your option space. We'll see you in the next deep dive.